Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, blessed souls, we can't fool ourselves before the Holy One. This is now Soul Class 357, Secular by Design, Part 5, because we're alive, because we want to stay alive. In Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim. We're now broadcasting live at about 10:31, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unifying Souls. Actually, our efforts will be directed towards reading from Alan W. Cecil's seminal work, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. This reading will hopefully engage you, blessed souls, to consider the term intellectual, the insidious child of anti-Semitism, which reared its ugly head during the 19th century with an even more insidious intent of luring Hebrew, Israelite, Jewish people away from the laws and instructions of Moses, the Levite prophet, as they were transmitted to him from the Almighty Creator of creation. And of course, tonight and the next 2 days, we'll be celebrating 3,327 years ago, received what the world calls the Ten Commandments, which really include the whole 613 commandments. You can join in the jam by calling in 347-838-8669 and bring your own spiritual peanut butter. And I also want to suggest humbly that everyone should be blessed to merit to purchase Mr. Cecil's book, which again is called Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. And in the background we hear Rabbi Arya Goldwag finally here, a song about the coming of the Messiah, the Mashiach, the one that we of Israel have according to our oral and written traditions, which we understand that he has not come yet, not to bruise or offend anyone. Also, I want to mention as a caveat that anything that I or my two co-hosts who are listening in patiently are going to say, we are not the final authoritative word. We are activists in our own right, seeking to serve up an aroma to arouse your desire intellectually to connect more in an internalized and meaningful manner with your divine image, which will help you go up and scrimmage. Your Tzelem Elokim is no dream. And first, I'd like to call our senior co-host, Dennis Ryan, our Rambam teacher, host, student, advocate for the dissemination of teachings of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, and of course, the author of Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, Mr. Alan W. Cecil. Good morning, gentlemen.
Baruch Hashem.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov. And Dennis, please meet Alan. And Alan, I'm happy to introduce you to Dennis Ryan.
Hello,
Alan.
How do you do?
Okay. And Alan is calling from the Sunshine State of Florida. How's the weather down there, sir?
Hot.
Well, we're in Brooklyn right now, which we also known among ourselves as we call it the Brooklyn Boiler Room, because it not only gets hot, it gets pretty humid, but you're no stranger probably to humidity down in Florida. But hopefully our discussion today will get quite humid as well in the most positive sense, And I just want to mention to everyone out there listening, and you can also join in the jam, 347-838-8669, that none of us are the final word or the final authority. We are here to arouse people to do their own research into these matters. And, of course, we have Dennis Ryan. Gentlemen, I'd like to start off with a thought, and then we'll go into Mr. Cecil's overview, the beginning of the secular by design. And, of course, as I am accustomed to do, whenever I read something, I like to go around to my co-host to get their feedback, comments, questions, and concerns. So I'm going to start off with a letter from 1964, corresponding to the Hebrew lunar calendar date of 5724, written to inaugurate the month of Sivan, which we are in right now, for those of you not aware, written by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, may his merits protect us. And he mentioned this, the Rebbe, in the end, the concluding point of this letter that he wrote. We live in a time and in a country where, yes, there is external freedom in our society in general, but yet the young generation in particular are still largely enslaved and at a loss how to free themselves from the shackles of spiritual and mental confusion. Now, the Rebbe was being culturally specific, and we'll broaden it out in a second after I make it, you know, read his statement of cultural specificity. The only hope that Jewish children should not be swept with this stream of spiritual mental confusion lies in a Torah education where the golden chain of the Torah from Sinai is maintained, the Torah in all its sanctity, the Torah of truth, which is also, the Torah is also known as Bible, also means instruction and law, which always must remain intact and cannot be subject to compromise or concession. So I just, before I turn to my co-host, and I'll turn to Dennis first and then Alan, that in this time, openly invite all members of the human family experience to consider that regardless of their faith, regardless of the religion, regardless of their secular viewpoints, they have an open opportunity to learn matters which we, from a faith-based community perspective, say are of divine instruction, yet tailored to the human intellect, to elevate the intellect, to elevate the human experience as we understand it to be upon this living earth. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, the letter was interesting, but it's almost flowing against the tide, Don, because many years ago, you were always underneath the arm's length of your parents, and they sort of controlled, with the school, what you were educated as and what you learned. So they kept tabs on this. However, today, unfortunately or fortunately, I'm not going to judge it, we have open information on the Internet everywhere. You got little hand devices that start exchanging ideas just about everything. Someone wants to get up and blow their nose, they're going to tell you on their hand device. Well, that's wonderful. However, this becomes a distraction. When you're trying to educate people, you want to put them on the straight and narrow. It doesn't mean that you treat them like horses and put blinkers on them, but they have to be aware of what's going on. But at the same time, it's very important for parents and teachers to be able to tell the kids, you must concentrate on the fundamentals and basics. Why? Because that's your life. It's in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Alan, in 1964, believe it or not, and the years that followed during the 60s, the so-called Cultural Revolution, Lubavitcher Rebbe, it might seem surprising, he actually saw a positive aspect to the rebellion of the youth, because they were questioning the mores and the cultural values of their elders, not in the sense of rebellion, but because they wanted to seek out more. And for the person who's learning about their obligations for the 700 commandments, how can this perhaps meet a need, that perhaps they want to see more than just what they're getting from the general mainstream of we have in the communications industry right now, which can nurture them in a way that they feel like they can choose to go upstream or downstream, but yet they can feel a sense of they're getting unshackled from previous levels of intellectual or mental slavery through learning about the seven Noahic commandments?
Well, I think the Rebbe brought up a very good point. Youth is always traditionally, you get to the age, you know, your teenage years, and it's just kind of natural to want to rebel. To find your, that's a process, a part of finding your own identity. And, yeah, the youth back in the 60s was rebelling against the traditions as they saw were wrong. You know, it's there's always been that kind of it really was interesting back then, the viewpoints. The youth culture back in the 60s was all, you know, they were advocating peace, love, sharing, you know, a lot of what would go along with what the Torah was teaching. Today, the youth, I don't know, we've become so involved with commercialism and consumerism. And like mm-hmm. you said, you know, all the little handheld gadgets, that's people are, instead of talking to each other and communicating, they're tweeting or texting each other. Even the, I think today's rebellious youth movement, they're called hipsters, are very materialistic oriented. You know, you have to wear the right glasses, the right clothes, have the right hairstyle, go to eat and shop at the right places. So how do you educate the youth into a positive area of change? You know, mm-hmm. what if you're going to rebel, you have to know what it is exactly you're wanting to rebel against, you know, mm-hmm. and what you stand for.
True. I just wish that, for instance, in the last year or two with the Occupy movements, whether it be out in California and Wall Street, I wish some of the people involved in the Occupy would understand that they really want to get occupied in something more than just saying, no, we don't want like this. We don't like the current situation, that they can understand that they can offer solutions. Wasn't in the 60s that there was a mantra, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem?
Don?
Yeah. Yes, Dennis.
What happens is each generation rejects the previous generation. In the 60s, they turned that into fadism, so to speak. And that's what I think Alan was saying, that's a result of today, that we're differentiating everything now, and it's like it has to fit into the correct spot. Unfortunately, we never educated those young kids to tell them that God is a constant and that your social values can switch whichever way you want. Chick items, ideas can come and go. Fadism is temporary. But there are things that are going to last you, just like they lasted your grandparents and their parents before them and their parents. Why? Because there's certain things that stand the test of time. And we have to emphasize them. We don't do it enough.
Sure. Before we go further into the reading from Alan W. Cecil's overview from his, again, I call it a seminal work. I personally, Dennis, I hope one day that you'll get access to the book. I personally think, Alan, that you should have been awarded a PhD by the United Nations, if not the United States government, for your efforts to open up a new dialogue, a new consciousness. And I would call it to be a way to reinvigorate the laws that have already been laid down on this land and to upgrade and lead them to more than just being, as some people are starting to look at the laws and looking at them as dried and old statutes and then implementing new statutes and laws and propositions which are contrary to the original spirit as much as it could have been positive in the intentions of the founding fathers. But before we do that, I just want to mention from last week's program, Dennis, you weren't, I don't know if you heard the archive version, but I did my first, or Alan did his first co-hosting with myself, and we read from page 17. There were three particular authors, Richard Dawkins, a British evolutionary zoologist who wrote a book called The God Delusion, and again, I have mercy upon him for promoting that type of idea, and Christopher Hitchens, who unfortunately passed away, but unfortunately promoted ideas which are very antithetical to what all of us of the faith-based community adhere to by promoting the idea that, and again I say, Hashem have mercy on him, God is not great, and then Sam Harris's End of Faith. And this whole axiomatic viewpoint that they take about not believing in Hashem, not believing in God, or promoting the idea there is no God, I'd like to give a Torah perspective, and then I'll go around, I'll start with Alan for feedback, and I'll go to Dennis. King David described this person who does not believe in God, and it goes like this. In chapter 14, verse 1, for the conductor of David, the degraded man says in his heart, there is no God. And he goes on to say, they acted corruptly and despicably, and not one does good. So the Ibn Ezra, who was a classic rabbinical commentator from the period called the Rishonim, over 700 years ago, I believe, describes this person as the opposite of a wise person because he is degraded and foolish enough to think that there is no God. Now, what we're saying this is according to a Torah cultural value-based system, which every person has to come to their own decision where they stand on this, that is foolish and is a degradation to a person's dignity to consider that there is no God. In fact, in a very psychological elaboration on this teaching, Harav Eliyahu Meir Block observed that the most eloquent proof of the true existence of God is the very fact that the wicked man must constantly soothe his conscience by declaring there is no God. And in my field, in the mental health field, this is being obsessed and compulsive about a certain belief. If a person has no strong feelings about a creator, then he or she merely says, okay, there is none, and goes up weiter. But the fact that they have to obsess about trying to prove the point that there is no creator, there is no source of all creation, to me indicates, and again, I might be right, I might be wrong, and I'm not bringing a source from Torah, I'm just saying subconsciously it indicates to me that something is bothering them, that they have to be so occupied in trying to say or pronounce and promote the idea there is no God. Now, Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, or Dennis, we really haven't talked about, but Alan, throughout his book, actively promotes the teachings of Rabbi Raphael Shamshon Hirsch, and also asks Alan to comment on my following statement, that Rabbi Raphael Shamshon Hirsch lived in the 19th century among Jews who lived in Germany, where there was extremely intense anti-Semitism. And in a sense, he tried to do something on his level, which I think was akin to what Rambam tried to do at his level 600, 700 years before, basically trying to show the Jewish people and to evidence to the non-Jewish population in Germany or in Europe that we can integrate the best of all different types of ideas, but we must keep it within the framework of a system which will never go away, which is the Torah system. So Rav Hirsch talks about this degraded man who says in his heart, and he likens him to a withered leaf that has no life nor potential for growth. Now, when I think I'm going to speak exponentially, I think Rav Hirsch was alluding to, no, a person is going in sort of like a chaotic, deterministic type of thought process where there's no room for thinking what we call the proverbial outside of the box type of scenario. And what happens is in the heart of this person who is called degraded, according to King David, there is a total succumbing to merely temporal external lusts and passions. And this is because a person has made a blockage between himself and Ralph Hirsch mentions that which is the person, him or herself, and the image that they're made in, namely the image of God, and they're basically trying to extinguish, although it's a futile attempt, to say there is no divine spark, there is no consciousness of something beyond our own secular humanistic values, because in their heart there's this rumination that there is no God. So I've said a lot, Alan, but I'm sure you have a nice follow-up to what I've said, whether it be a common question or concern.
Well, this raises the question of absolute morality. You know, is there a system? And, of course, for those of us who follow the Torah, the answer is yes. The rebellion against it is usually because of reason. People are so, they can't give up either their idolatry or their hedonism. It's usually one of those two things, as other commentators have pointed out. And that is such a big problem today because those are the things that have been in our culture here in America, in Western culture in general, you know, the ideas, and this is all based on, the Western civilization is all based on Greek and Roman ideas and ideals. And, of course, you know, anyone who has been a student of Greek and Roman history knows that idolatry and hedonism were fairly rampant in those societies. That is what we're having to battle against. And it's not, I mean, it is a foundational problem. You have a society that is, the foundation of which is a hedonistic and idolatrous foundation, promoting those ideas. How do you switch? How do you get people to understand that we need to base it on something, like you said, that is permanent?
My axiomatic statement, which again, that just as Rambam tried to integrate and elevate Rav Yishol Shimshon Hirsch in Germany, 19th century Germany, was, I think, kind of going in the way of Rambam, trying to integrate different viewpoints, whether it be secular Jewish or religious Jewish, and even communicating. I mean, I don't know how much well-known he was known in Germany among the Gentile population, but I would imagine that since that he was the chief rabbi over there, his ideas must have filtered out into the Gentile population to consider another way of looking at not only the Jewish people of 19th century Germany, but themselves. Any comment on that? And do you think that he was like assuming the mantle that Rambam had did 600 years ago to integrate and elevate?
Well, the people like Rambam and Hirsch and Rabbi Schneerson, who had a very wide range of knowledge, not only in Torah, but in secular studies as well, understood the problem and what needed to be done. And it's really interesting, going back to the 60s, there was a television show in America called Star Trek, and right. One of the actors, one of the main actors, Leonard Nimoy, who was a son of Russian Orthodox Jewish immigrants, he devised a character based on rabbis, Mr. Spock. It was. I mean, it was based in his whole philosophy, which the fans of Star Trek, which you call them Trekkies or whatever, it's very well known. It's called IDIC, Infinite Diversity in Infinite Combinations. And it's a philosophy where all your differences should not separate you. You should accept that everyone is different, and this should be a strength, that all these different perspectives should come together and create something new and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And this philosophy, according to Majel Barrett, the wife of Gene Roddenberry, the one who created Star Trek, they got this from Maimonides, from his Guide to the
Perplexed. Wow.
The whole philosophy of Star Trek is based on Maimonides.
Wow. Dennis, did you hear that?
Yeah, not too many people know about this.
Well,
wow.
Where else could they pick up wisdom for free? And at the same time, find that it's useful no matter what time frame you're in.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a beautiful point.
The Guide to the Perplexed will last for eternity.
Yes, go ahead, Alan, please.
Go ahead.
You
can see how these ideas, in some of the strangest ways, can filter into our society. Unfortunately, very few people understand that connection that they did. You can go online on YouTube, look up, Leonard Nimoy, like the hand gestures that he does, the Vulcan,
right,
when he raises
right.
his hand. There's videos that show him explaining, I got that from the Kohanim blessing.
That's right.
And there's other things from Judaism. And a lot of the producers and people and the scriptwriters who wrote for Star Trek were Jewish, and they incorporated a lot of Jewish elements into the original series. These were kind of weeded out in later shows, later Star Trek series.
The movies.
In the original
and that,
episode,
yeah.
the Vulcans based on Israel, a people who based themselves on logic. They were basing that whole concept on the rabbinical on rabbinical logic and the system of thinking that there is a absolute morality, right and wrong. There's a logical way to approach everything. It's very much Torah centered. There's a way to figure out logically what the right thing to do is.
I just want to comment before Dennis comes on to give his comment on this, is that I think if more rabbis were going around telling their congregants and the Gentile populations of the world to live long and prosper and offer to teach them how to that Vulcan knockout move where he puts the fingers behind the neck and gives a pinch, more people will be hanging out in synagogues and Ben Noah congregations to learn how to do this stuff. Dennis, your take on this is very fascinating to me. This is very revelatory, this is a fitting
Star Trek was sort of revolutionary in and of itself. When it started, there weren't many people that watched it, but I happened to watch it from the beginning, and I've been a Trekkie ever since. That's why I always liked the Guide to the Perplexed, because it sort of fit hand in glove. But anyway, Alan, I'm a big Roman historian and a Trekkie as well. So I love this discussion because these problems have been problems for a long, long time, and we have to start addressing them. But in our society today, we have little kids running around saying, "Oh, my God," and they actually use OMG as a standard signature for this, that, and everything. And what they end up doing is lowering the word God to common, ordinary usage without realizing it has meaning behind it. So we have to, or we've missed somewhere along the line in the educational experience, that the values that are needed to understand as you get older and grow have missed the mark to a certain extent. So yes, here we have Maimonides writing a book about perplexed people. Well, they're perplexed today too. One of the problems is that they just don't see the connection on an everyday basis of what they should be doing. They go about doing it without really using some little logic even, saying there's a reason for everything. But they don't stop because they end up doing it rather than reasoning it out. So what happens is we're creating... TV does it, the internet does it, all the media does it, is they pick up the speed because they don't want you really to think or ponder. Ponder is an old word. By the way, I just wanted to mention one thing that you mentioned, Don, and that was that guy Hitchens. Well, yep. The Rambam would have buried him with the word all, and he would have admitted to Hitchens that God is not great because he's all. We cannot use English language words to describe what God is, because he outclasses any word that you could use. So, goodbye, Mr. Hitchens. I'll pray for you, but you were on the wrong track.
I agree. With that being said, gentlemen, I'd like to go now and bless the listeners out there to go into the now overview. And we're going to go back to the 19th century. And something that I'll be honest with you, I've heard of it, but I never did research to it, and I'll go into that a little bit later on, why I have not studied anti-Semitism, even though I am a Semitic person. But let's put that on the back burner for a moment. It is not without a touch of irony that the term intellectual was itself a creation of anti-Semitism, and here Alan gives a footnote 18, that the term intellectual first came into use in France. It was soon exported at the time of the Dreyfus case, when so large a part of the intellectual community was aroused to protest against the anti-Dreyfus conspiracy and became involved in an ideological holy war on the French reactionaries. At that time, the term came to be used by both sides, by the right as a kind of insult, by the Dreyfusian or Dreyfusard intellectuals as a proud banner, and the source material for that statement was by Richard Hofstadter's Anti-Intellectuals in American Life, which I believe was written in 64, from pages 38-39. Continuing, the word intellectual came into its popular use during the Dreyfus scandal in France, which began in 1894 and lasted well into the 20th century as a disparaging slur for Dreyfus's supporters. The accusations against the Jewish French military officer Alfred Dreyfus were transparently flimsy, but there was a sudden pandemic of anti-Semitism which infected the proceedings and divided the French over this issue. The intellectuals were outnumbered, and Dreyfus was convicted and incarcerated. Throngs of the anti-Dreyfusards marched through the streets of Paris, chanting death to the Jews, and for one young Jewish reporter who was in Paris covering the Dreyfus affair for a Budapest newspaper, it was a clarion call that the Enlightenment had failed. Anti-Semitism had not been cured, it had only been remission in Christian Europe, and the roots of anti-Semitism ran deeper into European psyche than anyone had realized. It became painfully obvious that the motto of Libertaire, I don't know how to say French, I'm trying to give an approximation of how it's written in the book, Libertaire, Egalite, which I guess is egalitarian, or fraternal, that seemed to be so promising in a century earlier did not include the Jews. Like so many of life's chance encounters, being at the right place at the wrong time or the wrong place at the right time can have life-changing consequences, and if a person is not an intellectual of drive and energy, these consequences can ripple out into society. The blatant display of anti-Semitism in the streets of Paris was a shock to the young Jewish reporter, for he himself was a quote-unquote secular Jewish intellectual who had embraced the ideas and sentiment of the Enlightenment like many others of his generation, and he shunned traditional Jewish education, acquiring a doctorate in law from the University of Vienna rather than rabbinical ordination, which we called smicha at a yeshiva, and he, as did so many other assimilated Jews, had assumed that the Christians of Europe had overcome anti-Semitism the same way they had overcome serfdom and slavery. For the troubled young Jewish reporter, the witnessing of the outpouring of anti-Semitism in the streets of Paris became a major turning point in his life. And so, the young Jewish journalist Theodor Herzl would leave Paris pondering where the Jewish people could find a safe haven away from the anti-Semitism that once again began spreading its poison throughout Europe. Dreyfus was convicted of treason and sent to Devil's Island in French Guiana, and from this sorry episode in Western history, both the term intellectual and the modern state of Israel developed. None too soon, for in less than 40 years, a Jewish generation, the concentration camp at Dachau, would be open for business. The Dreyfus scandal marked the public reemergence of anti-Semitism in Western Europe after a short Enlightenment period when Christian Europeans, at the advice of their great thinkers and philosophers, gritted their teeth and tried to be quote-unquote nice to the Jews, letting them out of the ghettos and treating them more or less as real human beings and fellow citizens. It might have worked, too, except that the great thinkers and philosophers of Europe had an ulterior motive to destroy Judaism with kindness, separating Jews from the law of Moses by enticement, attempting to make the Jews understand how much better the secular way of life was than to be yoked to the archaic laws of the Torah. It almost worked, too. A great many of the Jews of the 19th century did, in fact, give up Judaism, particularly in Western Europe. Try as they might, however, these emancipated and assimilated Jews never fit in with the polite European society. There was something too Jewish about them. By the end of the 19th century, Christian Europe was losing patience with its be nice to the Jews experiment, and the forcing smile that held for nearly a century gradually turned into a snarling rictus. Ellen, this is pretty heavy stuff, and to tell you the truth, here I am 52 years old, and I never went deep into learning about the Dreyfus Affair. In fact, I was not raised by my own family, who are not particularly, what would you call, Torah observant Jews, but they're good Jews. They have their mitzvahs that they do. And we were kind of raised, I was raised in a culture until I came back to a Torah lifestyle of, not that we don't talk about those things, but we try not to stick out. But you made a very seminal point was made in this book that somehow we always seem to stick out. And regardless of us agreeing with others whose ideas are antithetical to Torah, even hostile to Torah viewpoints, there's just this thing that exists within the mindset, or did exist in the mindset of 19th century Europe, and as I grew up in 20th century America, in middle class America, in Paramus, New Jersey, from time to time I would get pricked and poked, but it was never the essential thing. And again, I just only my perspective on how I was particularized by my family, not to be so particularly mindful of the fact that there are people who don't like me. What do you think is the instruction here that you're trying? What? Let me just say, what the point you're trying to bring out here is that people are just so oblivious to the fact that Jews were not liked or hated even in the 19th century, and how is that setting up the reader for the rest of the book by talking about what happened in 1894 with Alfred Dreyfus?
Well, I think it goes back to a point that you made earlier with the intellectuals of today. It is not, especially the Jews, that these people are railing against or that they don't like. It is God. They are rebelling against God and the idea of an absolute morality, an absolute law that all humans are supposed to follow. And the Jewish people, and that's what they were created for, represent this law. And that is what people don't like.
True.
Every Jew...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Don?
I just want to make a point, let Alan, and then you'll respond to that. But Alan, I just want to point out, as a activist and a promoter of dissemination of the Seven Noahic Commandments, that a Gentile, a Ben Noah, who is acting corruptly against another Gentile, is also rebelling against God. Because the vast majority of the Seven Noahic Commandments are about relations between human to human, with a minimal emphasis on emphasis between man and God in the Seven Noahic Commandments. So how come it's not understood that by, you know, not loving, by a killing or abortion or other things or hideous acts, because it's written squarely in Genesis that a person who kills another person, his blood will be required of by God, because in the oral Torah tradition, he's basically driving out Hashem's presence, which was present in that human being who just was murdered in a premeditated fashion.
And yeah, it has some serious consequences for our society. Even our, when you look at our justice system, you know, I've read things where I think they said that there's something like 4% of the prisoners who are put to death on death row were completely innocent. Mm. In our society, we incarcerate more people in America than any other country, even China, Russia. We have over 2 million people locked up. Mm-hmm. And for 4% of the people who are put to death, you know, who receive a death sentence are innocent. You know, the Torah is pretty clear. It's better to set 1,000 guilty men free than to execute one innocent person. Mm-hmm. And we just don't seem to care about that.
True.
And you know, it's a problem.
Dennis, you've been very patient. Please chime in.
Well, I've done a lot of work on being prejudiced, biased, and anti-Semitism is right up there at the top. Why? Because you're both right, but you're wrong about the overall situation. And don't get me wrong, I'm not making a judgment here, but you distinguish yourselves from the normal people, that is Jews, because you have intense training and you're taught to follow some type of logic. Well, a lot of other people who believe you should change or adjust then feel like you're not really part of them and you're holding something back. So because you're somewhat educated or trained, you make yourself different from the other people who say, well, I can handle anything. Well, you are a lot more not conservative, but a lot more polite in what you do because you're not going to do something you don't know. While we have a lot of people who believe that they're capable, their egos are, that they can jump into anything, whether they're trained or not. Why? Because they can handle it. So over the years of history, and Alan, you brought up part of it, and Don, you questioned it to a certain extent, and that is, that you don't realize how you differentiate, Jews don't realize how they differentiate themselves from other people because you're not going to jump at a new idea that comes along. And other people are saying, but this is a good idea. But some people will say, especially Jews, let's think it through. In other words, if you said, I'm going to have a pool party, how many people are going to make sure that there's water in the pool? We have this human problem. And Alan is correct in saying it's really an indirect rejection of God, which is true. But we do it through other people. We do this on a human level. What we don't like, and what I don't like, is because we settle these things on a human level, we transfer it to the spiritual level. So what do? Because these people happen to believe going down street A, that we should let them all go down street A to keep them away from us. But why? What's the fear? What? To me, it's a modified form of jealousy. But what happens is nobody wants to admit it. Why are Jews different? Not because they want to be, because that's what they are. They're Jews, and they have a history they follow, and they don't deviate that much. While a lot of people are saying, well, we got to change. We got to blah, blah, blah. You can't change the basics relating to God. And we have to teach people that there's certain things that humans have to learn to understand how to deal with other humans and God himself.
I agree with what you're saying, Dennis, and I'm not trying to soften the consequences of the last several thousand years of anti-Semitism. I'm definitely aware of it. I'm just letting you know that in my particular family culture, we didn't talk about how the Gentiles hate us, you know, and because we were so involved, and up until I was 23 and a half, I did not have a Torah education. I had a secular humanist activist, because my father he still is, although he's in a retired stage now, of this an anti-nuclear and pro-alternative, or as the Lubavitcher would call it, a pro-endless energy supply viewpoint with solar and wind and hydroelectric and hydroelectromagnetic. But I just want to bring out one point, gentlemen, that I want to share with you both, a perspective that I have, because I am, as a Jew, and I am preparing tonight to, as part of the Nation of Israel internationally, to receive the Torah, to rededicate ourselves, and also it's an open invitation for anyone of the nations of the world to rededicate themselves to learning more about the Torahs, in particular the Seven Noahic Commandments, that 3,327 years ago, right before the giving of the Torah, Israel was of the Jewish halachic status of still being Ben Noach, meaning we were all of the Gentile nations, although, of course, the nation of Israel was separated out in the way we uniquely did going out of Egypt. But I'm saying the nation of Israel as it exists today is only 3,327 years as of tonight, because the Talmudic tractate, I think in Bava Basra, which deals with civil laws, talks about we went through a conversion process to become the people that we are today. But there was, up until that point, from the time of Adam, with the brief interruption with the flood, the great flood in the time of Noah, there was 2,448 years, according to tradition, of human existence. And there were a lot of wise people among the nations, even before they were called nations, and then the nations basically kind of crystallized and congealed, as depicted after the event of the flood. So and there was knowledge of the Seven Noahic Commandments. The problem was it was very hard to enforce them up until the time of the giving of the Torah, because there was definitely great amounts of idol worship going on in the time of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and of course in Israel and in Egypt. And of course the Israelites who knew about the Seven Noahic Commandments couldn't go to their host country and start telling them to tear down their idols, because they probably would have been all put to death at that point, God forbid. The point I'm trying to say is that there was a mass consciousness. I mean, human beings are, by nature, intellectually geared beings. My question is, Alan, what do you think? What do you think was the breaking point where, from Mount Sinai onward, were kind of the nations, they got a little bit confused because of, so to speak, the promotion of the Jewish people, but the point of the matter is still, if we're looking from the context of 5,774 years into this creation, according to the written Torah tradition or oral Torah tradition, we're still talking about more than 40% of human history is devoid of what we call the classic Jew or Israelite, and that's a lot of consciousness which should have filtered down to have overcome this jealousy, to overcome this anti-Semitism, and again, last but not least, to overcome this degradation of fellow human being according to the seven high commandments. Your comments on this?
Well, I think we touched on a good point. Why hasn't this knowledge been taught? And that is a big part of what I write about in the book, is mm-hmm. that there was a coercive effort to keep this knowledge away from the general population. You know, they teach in our schools, you know, colleges, universities, they teach religion, but they do not teach Torah, and they do not teach rabbinic logic. I mean, they'll teach every other form of logic and thought, but not that. Why is that? I mean, that is a good question. I really don't have an answer other than people just want to do what is wise in their own eyes. And they just, like, as I said before, people just don't want to give up their idolatry, which is whether or not it's the love of another god or money or material possessions or hedonism. Those are the two main factors.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your take on these matters. Why hasn't there been a transmission? And in fact, there is an older tradition of how to live than the Torah tradition. The Torah was in a more humbled, condensed form prior to the giving of the quote-unquote Ten Commandments to the Jewish people. What stopped this transmission of human reason and human knowledge and human awareness of godliness? Because Noah was a prophet. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were, in the Jewish halachic sense, children of Noah. He also had the righteous Hanoch. He also had the son who plays Cain. Why am I forgetting his name? Cain. After Cain passed away, after Abel passed away, there was. Well, his name is escaping me. But the point is, Dennis, there were wise, godly people among the nations. What stopped them from, you know, what stopped them from having their own Abrahams? To allow the nations to have a tradition where they'd be more respectful of the Jewish people and respectful of themselves.
Well, I think you brought it up. Believe it or not, here I am, and I've spent my lifetime going over what are the differences between these religions. If most of them started with Moses, where the blazes did they go wrong? How come we have people going to the left and the right and backwards even? And Moses had the word of God. What
right.
went wrong? Why are we now diverse entities all over the place, but we agree it's the same God? And we go about it every day. I'll do my thing, you do your thing, and hopefully we'll meet in heaven. But we won't do it together. Why? Because somebody drew a line somewhere and said, just like you did inadvertently in your explanation here, Don, you said, how come they don't have their Abrahams? Abraham was unique. So it looked like Abraham belonged to the chosen people. The people who aren't chosen don't accept Abraham because he's one of the chosen. So inadvertently, by emphasizing the good points that you have, you inadvertently started alienating other people because humans are sensitive to this. So they don't say, Abraham, my father, but a lot of Jews say that. I mean, that's why they picked up on Jesus. Why? Because they could say he was different. He wasn't really one of them, even though he was Jewish. But what happens is what is written to a lot of people say, well, that's the Jewish people. When in effect, it's not the Jewish people. It's humanity. So the real question is, why do we separate Jewish people from humanity? Well, a lot of people do it, and it could be jealousy, it could be hate, and other things. And the strange thing about the Dreyfus Affair, I got to go back to that. I knew it well. I read the book over and over, not Ellen's book, but maybe I will. And that is the basis for the moral problem here can you accept someone in authority who's Jewish? Well, the whole affair, the whole justice system, had nothing to do with justice, had nothing to do with being Jewish. It was the cause of everything. So therefore, people who thought that Dreyfus was right, but he couldn't have been because he was Jewish. So this is a moral problem that we have, and that is that the people who are smart enough keep to themselves. They don't like to mix because they're not going to compromise. While the other people who are not Jewish are saying, I don't know if I want to compromise. So we have this standoff, and the standoff goes down. Yes, it's been going on for over 3,000 years, and it's a shame.
With that being said, going back to the part of page 21 from the overview of Secular by Design by Alan W. Cecil, I picked up on this point about the great thinkers, the great and philosophers of Europe had an ulterior motive to destroy Judaism and kindness, separating Jews from the law of Moses by enticement, attempting to make the Jews understand much better the secular way of life was better than the yoke to the archaic laws of the Torah. I'd like to give a small terse description of Moses, described as a social activist, and see why we would want to cast off the yoke of the Torah when we have such a living example from back then and for all days about why we Jewish people are and what we identify with. And this was written by Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik in Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind, Chapter 5, and that chapter is called Civil Rights and the Dignity of Man. At the beginning of the Exodus, the Torah relates three episodes in Moses' life before God designated him the deliverer of the Jews from Egypt. On the first day that Moses went out to his people from the house of Pharaoh, when he was raised, he saw an Egyptian striking a Hebrew. Here the outstanding quality of Moses first reveals itself, and some opinions hold that he was young as 18 years old at the time of this incident. With an overwhelming passion for justice and righteousness, the inability to tolerate a crime, Moses hastily looked around and rushed forward to defend the Hebrew against the Egyptian aggressor. This, the first act in Moses' life as a grown-up, represents parts of the tzedek, the justice and righteousness, that is to be realized in the realm of Gentile versus Jew relationships. But then the Torah tells us that Moses went out again and this time saw one Jew smiting another. Moses rushed out to the aid of the victim, defending him against the aggressor. This second act of Moses represents his dedication to the cause of justice and righteousness in the realm of Jew versus Jew relationships. As a result of this second act, however, Moses was forced to flee Egypt. The once pampered Egyptian prince of the royal household became a homeless, hunted refugee. Moses came to a well where he witnesses another act of injustice. The local shepherds drive away the shepherd daughters of Jethro so that the shepherd can water their flocks first. Here Moses enters a dispute between the non-Jews, a matter seemingly so unimportant to him that we might have understood that if he had just stood idly by, hadn't he learned his bitter lesson already by interfering between the two quarreling Jews? Did not discretion urge him to mind his own business? Our sages say that Moses represents tzedek, which is justice. The concept of tzedek, as we've begun to develop, is to be pursued in three different realms. First, as Moses taught us, a Jew must be on guard not to allow injustice in the relationship of a non-Jew with a Jew. Second, a Jew must be careful that justice be shown in relationships between Jews. And third, the incident by the well of Midian teaches us that Moses was bent upon emulating the ways of God. One is which is to defend a victim from an attacker. As the verse says, quote, God takes the side of the aggrieved and the victim, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 15. In Moses' mind, the pursuit of righteousness and justice was paramount. No consideration could stand in its way. Quote, and Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flocks, Exodus chapter 2, verse 17. A Jew should always identify the cause of defending the aggrieved, whoever the aggrieved may be, just as the concept of tzedek is to be applied uniformly, or justice is to be applied to all humans, regardless of race or creed. Again, that's right, Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now, gentlemen, Alan, I'll turn to you. If we had not identified this as Moses, but just say so-and-so, say John Doe, I would think that many people who are, quote-unquote, in the category of freedom fighters or liberals or even ultra-conservatives, anyone who would hear of these values would embrace them. So why would these great thinkers and philosophers, and I'm assuming they're quite unaware of this type of persona or psyche that existed in Moses, why would they have, because Jews, according to Torah, would have helped those great philosophers and thinkers to make Europe a more just society. Aside from the fact that they had their own desires or they had their own ideas, and even if we take out the fact of jealousy, was it just I don't know. What, any comments, questions, concerns on what I just read, and why it was really to the it was really an undermining of Europe's security, which led to the First and Second World War, which couldn't be avoided if Torah values were integrated into those societies.
Well, I think you brought up. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Alan.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you brought up the example of John Doe. I really think it should have been John Dostein or John Doberg. that's not the non-Jewish thought pattern, as you pointed out, is different than the Jewish one. Even secular Jews are brought up with a sense of morality. And again, like, this goes back to Abraham. That's why the Jews were chosen. They had this innate sense of morality and doing what is right, the social justice. I'd like to read, you're aware of Immanuel Kant, the great
Sure.
German philosopher. Here's a statement he made. He said that the Jews should be led to the final end. We consider the proposal of Ben David, a highly intelligent Jew, to adopt publicly the religion of Jesus, presumably with its vehicle, the gospel, a most fortunate one. The euthanasia of Judaism is pure moral religion, freed from all the ancient statutory teachings. In other words, his plan was to eliminate Judaism, just have like a mushy kind of moral religion, again, which fits in with the non-Jewish, you know, well, do what's right in our own eyes, and separating the law from morality. And, you know, as you know, that just can't be done because
right.
It is those ancient statutory teachings which teach us what is right and wrong. But even, and this is a man who, was one of the great philosophers of modern times,
mm-hmm.
and this sort of sentiment is repeated over and over again in non-Jewish thinking. We've got to eliminate Judaism. We've got to get rid of those old, archaic, statutory laws, you know, the teachings of the Torah, so we can do our own thing.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your take on these matters?
Well, I believe Alan is partially right, but to me, Moses is the center of everything. But unfortunately, Moses doesn't have a last name. So we have a problem from a human viewpoint of identifying. And a lot of people, when they explain him or educate him about Moses, they don't really explain his human side. They explain his Jewish side. His human side is all-encompassing. And therein lies the problem. If you tell everybody that Moses was a Jew, there's no problem with that. But a lot of other people say, why? Doesn't he represent all the people, or did he just represent Jewish? So the concept is Moses was a great, great human, and we must be able to get that across to everybody, because then you can start educating them about what Moses thought was important. But if you only talk about extreme, narrow religious side of Moses, you're dehumanizing him. And to me, Moses is the key to a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just trying to...
Yes, I take an untraditional way of this.
I'm trying to...
Yes, I know. You're trying to abrogate it.
My wrap my head because...
Let's look at the commentary in Devarim, in Deuteronomy 27, I think it's 27:8. It talks about how Moses erected these pillars of stone, and he wrote the Torah in the 70 languages of men.
Right.
He wanted to for everyone to understand the Torah.
True. And with that being, I want to bring up a teaching which embellishes that point, Alan, which, again, a lot of people are just not aware of because it's never been told them, and they might have been interested, but hopefully with a teaching like this, that people will become more interested in learning Torah as it relates to assuming a level which was even higher than the level of Moses, not from the prophetic level, but from the level of learning Torah as a human being, because, you know, of course, Moses was a master of the Torah. He got the Torah. But it says this, that in the Talmudic tractate of Avodah Zorah, which is the oral Torah tradition of what to learn, how not to engage in idolatry, it says that, and I like to say in the affirmative, either as a, it says a non-Jew, but a Gentile or a descendant of Noah who engages in the study of Torah is comparable to the Kohen Gadol. Now, the Kohen Gadol had a certain privilege once a year to go into the Holy of Holies, which not even the likes of Moses went in at for a certain prescribed time before Aaron was officially anointed as the Kohen Gadol, as the high priest of Israel. Moses originally assumed that role, but then he was told to transfer that role to Aaron, his older brother. And there's a point brought up by the Talmudic tractate in Bava Kamma, page 38, side A. How do we know that even a Gentile or a Ben Noah who studies Torah is comparable to the Kohen Gadol, the high priest? It is written, quote, if a person does them, he shall live by them. And that's written in Leviticus 18:5. The verse does not speak of priests, Levites, or Israelites, but a person. From this we can understand that even a Gentile or a Ben Noah who studies Torah is comparable to the Kohen Gadol. So that's how I can better, Dennis, I understand where you're coming from. That's how I can understand it, is that anyone who wishes to learn the Torah with the intent of learning what their obligations of this world is, they assume, again, it's not saying that there's nothing wrong with the status, and I try to, I pour my hat out to other people who are children of Noah. You are just as desired by God than I am, because if we were both given roles of what to do in this world, that means he loves both of us. The fact that all the pronouncements in the written and oral tradition talked about God's love of the Jewish people is because we were given more responsibility. And again, that doesn't make us better. It's just like, so to speak, like the pitcher and catcher relationship in, say, like a perfect game. Now, there's no way a pitcher in baseball is going to pitch the perfect game if he doesn't have the catcher to catch the ball, call the pitches he should throw, and throw the ball back to the pitcher. There has to be this symbiotic relationship, and I pour out my soul as one member of the Jewish people to encourage people, go and take your portion that you can assume this dimension of high priest within your own living experience to integrate and learn about the seven Noahic commandments. And not only that, in another place, Rambam talks about in the conclusion of the laws of the Jubilee and the sabbatical year in his Mishnah Torah, that anyone can become like a Levite who declares his portion only is of God. Now, that person might still have to have a job, but if they choose God as their inheritance, they shall be blessed to see that they are living a life akin to what a Levite's lifestyle was back in the days when a temple stood. Alan, any comments on these viewpoints I'm sharing right now?
The quote that you just read from the Talmud is also repeated in Sanhedrin 59a, which is in the portion of Sanhedrin that's discussing the Noahide laws, and. Yeah, it says, you know, priests, Levites, and Israelites are not mentioned, but men, hence you may learn that even a non-Jew who studied the Torah is as a high priest. This is Rabbi Meir saying that there are seven words that are usually not added to this, but it comes right after. It says, that refers to their own seven laws. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, the way for a non-Jew to achieve this is through the study of the seven laws. I've talked to a lot of non-Jews who are all into Torah or Judaism, and there was just one yesterday I was talking with, you know, saying, oh, yeah, I try to keep Shabbat and try to eat kosher. And I say, well, what about the seven laws? And they're like, oh, well, I don't really, you know, pay much attention to those. But the Talmud is very clear. That is what the path of the non-Jew is supposed to be, studying the seven laws, not trying to do the things that were given to Israel only.
Yes, Dennis.
There's wisdom in Scripture, no doubt about that. You dug a little bit out when you started interpreting and explaining some of the Scripture. However, you also said that Jews are not better than Gentiles. But the Gentile comes back and asks the question, if you are chosen, how come you're not better? Now, it may not be a fair question. It may be a question of jealousy again, or maybe a little hatred involved. I don't know. But the answer to the question is interesting because are the chosen supposed to be better? Or in the Gentile eyes, they're not on an elevated level? Or maybe they're saying, you're no better than me. Well, we have to, this is one of the problems of understanding Judaism and understanding God at the same time. When we do human comparisons or human positioning, that has nothing to do with our spiritual relationship. So we can't be distracted by these human type of problems when, in effect, as the Rambam said, we should be thinking of spiritual positives.
Okay. I hear, but the thing is that the Torah was given in a way to live in this. The Torah is a definitely, it's a teaching of prophecy, but is also with the intent of working within this physical world. So there is a very high level spirituality, even in the laws, the Noahide commandments, and in the 613. But the whole point is that if we're going to have to face certain limitations within the human experience, because we are the only thing that's unlimited is the Almighty Creator. So, you know, to me, the dialogue has to come out, and that's why I'm enjoying so much this dialogue with both of you gentlemen. I'd also like to give a very cute, share a cute story of symbiotic relationship that actually occurred very recently. This was an article that was written in the Jewish press, and it was about a little 9-year-old Jewish boy. And it reads like this: for most 9-year-olds, a choice between Little League baseball and honoring a religious commandment would be an easy one to make. The mitzvahs might be nice but then when there's a game on the line, well, you know, but not for Yossi of Fountain Hills, Arizona, when an umpire told him he could not take his turn at bat recently. He calmly tried to explain to Yossi at 9 years old that he was wearing an illegal uniform because his uniform also had on his body tzitzis, you know, those little tassels that we Jewish people walk around with. The umpire, however, was unmoved and ordered Yossi to remove the tzitzis for fear that it could produce some sort of interference or unfair advantage. Now, Yossi was the only Jewish boy not only in the team but in the entire league. Yossi reacted by respectfully but assuredly walking off the field. In addition, Yossi's team also volunteered to forfeit the game in solidarity with Yossi. Eventually, following a lengthy on-field meeting between the coaches and the umpire, Yossi was allowed to play with double uniforms and all. So here I see is that what was brought out in the article here, that this little 9-year-old Jewish boy, who, by the way, from a Jewish law perspective, is not required to wear tzitzis at that point, but it's a matter of education to prepare him for a lifetime of wearing them as an adult from 13 years and older, that self-assertion also demands a lot of humility. Doing something out of the ordinary requires putting our image on the line. It means that I care more about my truth than what other people think about me. This is esteem that is rooted in soul consciousness. But at the same time, too, his Gentile Ben Noah teammates, they performed their role by walking off the field with him. So therefore, it wasn't about, you know, you're better than me or we're not as good as you. Is we agree with the stance that you're taking based on your 9-year-old understanding in God. And therefore, this is the type of, hopefully, relationship we'll see in the future where Jewish people will assert themselves with Torah standards. And more Gentiles, Ben Enoch, will say, for the Jew standing up for what he believes to be is the will of God, in this case wearing tzitzis, that this will hopefully reduce harassment and further repercussions will start to, you know, melt away like butter in the skillet. And hopefully this will lead to more, you know, toleration of lifestyles which are more in sync with God's plan for not only the Jewish people, but also for the children of Noah. Alan, your take on this? Yeah, yes, Dennis.
Two quick questions. One is, Are you one of us? That question was answered when the solidarity formed. In other words, you don't teach it, people feel it. Humans, being sentient beings, have to feel something. If they do, that gives them motivation. So are you one of us is a question that never may be answered completely.
Mm-hmm. Alan, your take on this, how this, an expression of symbiotic support, one for the other in the team, not only led to a resolution of this problem, but allowed him to actually resume his playing of the game, and hopefully this young boy became more esteemed in the eyes of his fellow baseball teammates and the league itself.
Well, I don't know the situation. Was it in support because he was Jewish, or was it a more liberal, humanistic support for the, you know, religious freedom for everybody? I mean, would they have done the same thing to a someone who is Muslim wearing a head covering, a turban or something? It's kind of hard to answer that question based on my insufficient knowledge of the situation.
It's a very good question. Yes, that one second. It's a very good question. I don't have the answer for it. But in this particular case, as you know, me being culturally sensitive to the situation, I enjoyed very much reading the story. How, you know, the boy didn't scream and yell. He just respectfully walked off the field, and then his teammates followed suit. I mean, obviously, I doubt that his teammates, and most children that age who are Jewish still in America per se still don't understand the significance of, say, actually is a rabbinical precept of wearing tzitzis as we wear them today, as opposed to thousands of years ago we were garments that were four-cornered and we according to the Torah itself be required to wear them. But the fact that there was just this reaction in this particular case stirred in my mind this idea that when a person stands up for what they believe in and it's perceived by others to be sincere, they will back up that person on their sincerity. If it had been a little Muslim boy, I mean, to tell you the truth, I would hope that his teammates would have taken the same stance.
Don,
yes, Dennis.
And the
we had a famous movie that's almost 20 years old. It ended with a line that said, "You don't have to have a badge on your uniform to have honor."
Mm-hmm.
It implied internally. If you know what you are internally, then externally doesn't mean that much more than what you have internally.
Mm-hmm. Alan, you want to add something before we read the next section from the overview?
I was just going to comment. I know that there's I don't really know the full halakha on wearing tzitzis, but I understand, that there are cases where you're not supposed to wear them, doing something unbecoming to what they represent. And I don't know, again, you have to question, why was he wearing them in a baseball game to begin with? Not that he shouldn't, I don't know. I don't know the whole situation. I'm glad his teammates did what they did, but the whole story just seems to be a little bit more sensationalistic than anything to me.
Okay, I hear you. I respect your opinion. I just do want to bring out this, though, that in terms of, yes, getting involved in activities which are unbecoming to the tzitzis, there are such matters, but we won't go into it now because if people want to, they can look up the laws in the Jewish code of law. But, in fact, several years ago, there was a basketball player of renown. His name was Tamir Goodman, actually not related to me as far as I know. And he was from, I think, the Maryland area. And he actually made it to the University of Maryland basketball team, I believe. I think he started in, I don't know what they call it, class one collegiate sports. He played at a lower level of collegiate level and then went up to the level of the University of Maryland. And he would wear tzitzis. And he talked about the idea that, in terms of playing sports, that should not be unbecoming to the wear of the tzitzis to wear them. In fact, he himself now has a company that he has designed tzitzis which meet the Jewish law requirements for wearing them. And with that being said, again, one can look up in the code of Jewish law in what circumstances one should, remove one's tzitzis. I'd like to go on further with the book in the overview as we continue to another, unfortunately, sad period in terms of historical anti-Semitism here now in the early 20th century. And it reads like reads as follows. Of course, it was not only in France that anti-Semitism reestablished itself after decades of dormancy throughout the continent. The old animosity towards the Jews would rekindle, often taking newer and subtler forms. Excuse me, I'm not pronouncing the word right. One of the major works of anti-Jewish propaganda was first published in the early years of the 20th century, during the very years of the bloody pogroms of 1903 to 1906, there appeared in Russia a short book entitled The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, another book I've heard of, but I've never read it myself, a work plagiarized from earlier political writings and most notably from a satirical work about Napoleon III, and was brought to the United States during the aftermath of the Russian Revolution, where it was translated to English by the Russian anti-Semites in America. The basic theme of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion can be summed up simply as, quote-unquote, the Jews are plotting to take over the world. Yet there is a question which no one has ever seemed to ask. Exactly who are the Jews supposedly taking the world from? It is simple logic that if the Jews were plotting to take over the world, then there would have to be some other more paranoid group, a group of people who were and are in control of the world in order for it to be taken over. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion did attract the attention of many Americans, notably Henry Ford, who published in his newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, where it was retitled The International Jew, The World's Problem. Ford's publication of Protocols in The Dearborn Independent would have considerable effect on the racial and ethnic climate in America. The greater impact of Ford's publication, however, would be felt in Germany, a nation widely considered to be the quote-unquote most civilized nation on earth in the early 20th century, where the Germans would develop a form of anti-Semitism that would prove to be deadlier than which any other previous culture had contrived. Excuse me. The Dearborn Independent caught the attention of many of Mr. Ford's great admirers in Germany, not the least of which was Adolf Hitler, who would incorporate many of its themes in his book Mein Kampf. This is a grim lesson we should take to heart, that anti-Semitism can affect any nation, no matter how sapient their art and music, no matter how refined their customs or their cuisine, no matter how haughty their manners, and no matter how educated their intellectuals. And I'd like to give my own little take on this. As far as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, last Saturday night after the Blessed Shabbos, I was listening to the radio here in New York City. There is a state senator by the name Dov Hyken. And State Senator Hyken had mentioned, and I don't know what his source for this, is that he claimed that in the Middle East, particularly in the Islamic countries, after the publishing in terms of sheer quantity, a volume of the Quran, the second most published work in the Middle East, translated into Arabic, is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And as well, I remember learning a couple years back that after the publishing of Mein Kampf in German, with those who had found fascination and liked the viewpoints of Hitler, mainly from the Middle East, that there was a version of Mein Kampf translated into Arabic. So we see from the parts of the Quran which are openly anti-Semitic, we see two other forms of intellectual, spiritual, emotional poison, the forms of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Mein Kampf, which are really not giving a fair opportunity for our Arabian cousins to get a more open stance look at we are cousins. Literally, we are cousins. In fact, in the Hebrew, the spelling of the word Ivri for Hebrew and the word Aravi are using the same Hebrew letters in the Lashon HaKodesh, Holy Tongue, except there's a switching around the letters because it's two different nations. I'd like to go to Dennis Rist's take on this, on how we're not surprised by anti-Semitism because so many people have filtered into their brains before they can reach any level of differentiation between right and wrong and good and evil to hate before they even are given a chance to be educated on how to love their neighbor as they love themselves.
Well, we have a lot of people who practice anti-Semitism, but when you first started your little speech there, Don, the author you were quoting said it went away for a while. Anti-Semitism never went away. It's just hidden. It's waiting to rear its ugly head at any time. I feel bad when you don't hear anything, because that means people are doing it in their minds. I rather know the people who are anti-Semites by their voice, their words. That way you know what you're facing. But when people don't want to even discuss it, as in the Dreyfus affair, they didn't want to discuss being Jewish or anything. They quickly transferred it to other things and made it a human problem, not a Jewish problem. So we have this thing that we do in all over the world, is that we have to blame somebody. And what else other than these upstanding people who are doing the same thing day after day, year after year, and they don't conform with us, and they want to keep doing their separate thing. Unfortunately, we consider the Jewish a problem until another problem that's bigger than Jewish problems occur. Then we put it in the back seat or the back burner, and we go after the latest problem. But when we have no other problems, we always seem to go down and figure out that there's a Jewish problem that we haven't discovered yet. It's a joke to a certain extent, but I don't think the Jewish people are creating a defense about it, because they're expecting this. And history has shown this is what people who are non-Jews like to do from time to time. So if you don't hear anybody cursing you or saying bad words or whatever it is, it's just a question of time. So Jewish people understand the historical impact, while the non-Jews think they're reinventing it each time. Unfortunately, history has facts behind it. But we must be able to tell people, that's why I emphasize Moses, that we have humans in common with each other, and our differences are minor compared to what we have in common.
True. And I'd like to turn to, and I just want to make a comment about the idea of the promotion, the idea of Jews are plotting to take over the world. It reminds me of a humorous personal story about myself. About 10 years ago, I had a Volvo, and it broke down, and I was with a friend of mine. We after Shabbos, we had a custom to go to another friend's house to have a after Shabbos Torah learning session. And before we could get to my friend's apartment in Flatbush, I still live in Crown Heights, my car broke down. And it broke down, lo and behold, close to Church Avenue, which is a predominantly Afro-Hispanic Christian area. And we had to actually push my car up a little way up a hill, and a young man, an Afro-Caribbean, helped me push up the car. And I told him, listen, you know, I don't have the money to call for the, I don't have money to pay for the towing of my car. I really appreciate what you're doing. He's like, ah, no problem. You don't owe me anything. He said, but by the way, you know, since we're talking, maybe you know you have one of your Jewish friends who own most of the housing in New York City. They can get me some good housing. I wanted to tell him, I really don't hang out with those people. I only hang out with the Jews who are plotting to take over the world, and I appreciate you helping me push my car as I plot to take over the world, even though I don't even have enough money to have my car towed. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, I have news for people. There are actually a lot of Jews living in poverty, just like there are a lot of Gentiles living in poverty. And with that being said as well, this hatred, unfortunately, you know, when the world gets tired or wants to reinvigorate their hatred of us, they never stop hating themselves. I mean, look what's going on in Syria in the, last 3 years? I think over 100,000 Syrians have been killed, and why do I not like that, even though, you know, people will say to me in my committee, shh, shh, be quiet, you know, at least they're not fighting Israel. But the point is, it's an open violation of the 7 Noahic Commandments. They shouldn't be killing each other. But yet, because their minds have been poisoned by those aspects of the Quran which can be given over to be misinterpreted, to commit such wanton murder, and if their minds have been poisoned by Mein Kampf, and if their minds have been poisoned by the protocols of the Elders of Zion, it seems to me, Alan, and I'd like to get your take on this, no matter how much they'll hate us, still, unfortunately, the Noahites, the Gentiles of the world, are leaving a lot of room to hate each other and do a lot of heinous things to themselves, more than they could ever dream in their wildest imagination what the Jews could plan to do. And I just want to mention one more thing. We are not planning to take over the world, blessed souls. We want to educate the world according to what the Torah says, and it's up to every person whether they want to accept these teachings or not. We're not going to force you because we don't have that power to do so. When Messiah comes, things might be a little different, but even then, when we're all living in Israel, we Jewish people will invite everyone to come to Israel, but you'll be left to regulate and legislate and correct your societies wherever you are all over the blessed earth. Alan, that's my segue to your take on these matters.
Well, I want to go back to a point that was raised. You know, the thing about anti-Semitism I mentioned in the book, it was that it did not go away. It was exactly as he said. It was buried under the surface. There was a polite veneer for a time, but the anti-Semitism was always there. Why is it always there? That you know what? Why haven't we done anything? And another point I brought out in the book, you know, you would have thought that during the Enlightenment, you know, if it was a real Enlightenment, anti-Semitism would have been eradicated as the irrational emotion and form of thinking it is, but it was not. Why is that?
It's a very, very, very good question. I mean, I will humbly suggest that if the good peoples of the world who are still not aware of it, and hopefully are becoming more and more aware, would understand that they can be empowered by the moral legislation that is embedded in the Torah as it relates to the Seven Commandments. And I'd like to read quickly from a one law in the Jewish Court of Law. I'd like to ask you, Alan, if you think this can be integrated into the Noahide Commandments, and then I want Dennis's take on it. He goes like this. It's the prohibitions against wronging a colleague through speech and deceiving people. That just as it's forbidden to wrong a colleague in trade or commerce, so too it is forbidden to wrong him through speech. As is written in Leviticus 25:17, a person should not cheat his colleague, and you shall fear God. This refers to wronging someone with words. Wronging someone with words is more serious than wronging someone financially because the latter can be repaid, while the former cannot. Furthermore, financial loss affects merely one's property, while this affects one's person. A person who cries out to God over being wronged through speech will be answered immediately. In particular, it is necessary to be careful that one does not wrong one's wife in this manner to distress her by speech. Women have a sensitive nature and are prone to cry, even through about minor things. God takes particular note of tears, as it teaches in the Talmudic tractate of 32b, the gates of tears are never locked. So my question is, Alan, is this doable? I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be easy, because it's not easy for Jewish people, to avoid wronging people in trade and commerce, and as well as wronging them through ill-expressed speech.
I remember reading a commentary that Esau, when he found out that his brother had taken his blessing, shed three tears, and the third one was held back, and that was the cause of so many problems down the road. You know, even an evil character like Esau, Hashem, you know, took notice of that he had been wronged in that sense. What do we do about wronging others in trade and commerce? Again, it has to do with education. The Torah has got to be taught in our culture, and the barriers that have been preventing this, it doesn't make any sense, really. Logically, ethically, any way you look at it, these things need to be taught. There are no excuses, rational excuses, let me add that, of why it has not been taught. Again, it goes back to the anti-Semitism that we've been discussing. It's just this notion of, you know, what the Torah represents, what Israel represents. People just don't want this in our culture. And the reasons for that are many and varied, but we've got to start thinking in a way where we can accept this. You know, the Greeks, going back to the Greek civilization, they were very, very... I can't think of the word right now.
Adamant.
Adamant. Well, not just adamant, but very. They looked at their culture as being a supreme culture. They looked down at anyone who didn't speak the Greek language or wasn't a part of Greek culture was a barbarian.
They were very zealous, I would suggest.
They were jealous. Well, I don't think they were. I think they were more egotistical than anything else. Oh, we're the greatest. Everyone else, you know, their culture, their language is of no consequence. The word barbarian came from the ba-ba-ba, you know, the nonsense sounds that they looked at people of other languages speaking.
Uh-huh.
And kind of like Babel, you know, same thing in Hebrew. It's same kind of idea.
I just want to, Dennis. What is your take on these matters? The idea that we can actually help reduce hatred, and hopefully not just anti-Semitism, but when a Gentile wrongs a Gentile, no one talks about that's being anti-gentility. I mean, you know, people are people, and it's also. And I'm not being an apologist. I want to be very clear. I don't want anyone to think I'm being apologetic for the anti-Semitism. I'm not. No, people who do wrong have to be taken to justice, and they will be. It's my simple faith, according to Jewish tradition, that whatever we do in this world, we're held accountable in the heavenly court. But the point is that there has to be a point where human beings should realize that we've got to be better with each other, starting from the very basis of dealing honestly in business and being more gentle with each other in speech. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Can humans love each other? We've been told by God we should, but can we practice it? Leviticus, that you mentioned before, said that when you do a wrong, you must right it. But there is no problematic way, a wise way of undoing the wrong that you do. In other words, we can identify the wrongs, but the remedies are very elusive, very hard to take, because people rather say, well, let's go on to the next thing. In other words, they can change the subject. But the thing that shocked me a little bit was in your discussion of where your car broke down, Don, and the guy was helping you, and he made an inquiry about housing. And you jumped along with his thinking from a Gentile viewpoint, which I thought was a little suspect. Why? Because he was talking to you as you were representing all the Jews. But you were an individual. But from a Gentile viewpoint, he was saying that if you talk to one, you talk to all. Well, why didn't he recognize that you are a human and you have your own personality and your own fingerprints? In other words, the labeling was active on a social level here. And that shouldn't have been, because if you start minimalizing or putting things into little squares and pegs, you're going to forget about the whole concept. And that's what the Greeks were very adamant about, was that their entire social life and environment, they didn't want any variations. They wanted you to stick with their rules and regulations, because to them, that was the only order. The other people who are barbarians really didn't have order, but the Greeks believe they did. But let's get back to Leviticus, and I'm sorry I'm jumping around like this, but Leviticus didn't say, how can you undo your wrongs? Why? Because there's a judgment involved. Do you want human judgment, or are you looking for spiritual judgment? We have to be very careful, because we can't mix and match.
I hear. I just want to point that, but if the human who does wrong hopefully become the human who will seek to undo the wrong that he or she has done. And so that's where the oral Torah tradition, and in particular, I just want to mention in passing as well, for those listening out there, that, for instance, there are three tractates in Talmud relating to civil conduct, Bava Basra, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, Bava Metzia, thank you, Alan, that deal with how one is supposed to act properly in the case of lost objects and business dealings. And those three tractates encompass, I think, at least 15 or maybe 16% of all the Talmudic discussions. And this is something that, you know, for those of the nations of the world and for Jewish people, if one wants to be quite accurate and quite upgoing and quite straight about their business dealings, as hard as it may seem, well, the instructions are aware of how to, in fact, conduct business correctly. And there are other parts of Talmud or Halacha where it talks about how to make restitution if one is consciously or unconsciously or mistakenly wronged one's fellow. Yes, there will be a need to ask for forgiveness, and there is a point where one also has to make supplications to God if one chooses to ask for forgiveness. But the whole idea is that if we created the problem, we can look for spiritual means of correcting it, but we also have to take physical acts, whether it be of the heart and the mind. And sometimes it talks about, we're talking about money restitution, if we've done financial damages, to make those type of corrections. With that being said, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you both profusely. Mere hours before we prepare ourselves for the 3,327th transmission of the Torah, as we'll be reading it tomorrow in our congregations all around the world. And I want to thank you, Dennis and Alan. Alan, Dennis, and I'd like to give you both the opportunity to make a signature conclusive statement. Then we're going to end off with our Flatchick artist, David Dome, singing one of his great new songs. Dennis, please, whatever you like to say, please share with our blessed audience.
Love yourself, love your fellow man, love God.
Alan?
Shavos 31a. The first thing a person is asked when he is brought for his final judgment is, did you do business honestly?
Thank you. And hopefully we will continue to carry out activities in that spirit as brought down in the tractate of Shavuos. Ladies and gentlemen, young men and women, young children, if you are somehow listening to this live program or you'll hear it as an archive version or you are young at heart, tonight we will be celebrating the giving of the Torah, and from our oral Torah tradition, that tonight and the next 2 days is a propitious time for making resolutions to want to increase one's knowledge of the Scripture and of the oral Torah traditions, whether you be Jew or Gentile, because we are all God's children. And if we said anything that might have offended you, blessed souls, we have a song now by David Dome, which is a song Offended, I find to be highly recommended. It's about helping us realize that sometimes we have to turn down the fire of our ego and listen to another person. And hopefully, if we share our points with others, sisters and brothers from different mothers, that we can come to realize life is no dream. We're meant to connect to our Tzelem Elohim, our divine image, will help us get scrimmage. And hopefully we'll continue next week with another edition of Soul Class, Secular by Design. And hopefully Alan will be available, and hopefully Dennis will be available. This is Dunzus Yu Goodman. We'll be doing it in a more contracted form today because I'm not working today. I have a chance to prepare myself for all those preparations necessary to receive the Torah again, once again, as a member of the Jewish Israelite people. Blessed souls, let's hopefully continue in a way of Ahava Chad, one love, Gora Lachad, one destiny, corner for all of us, Bodarchi Shalom, in a peaceful Darchi Noam, Laham Shik, to be continued, Bez Hashem Yisparek. Take care, everyone.
creeping up the grapevine. Because you're so easily
clouds only spoil the fun. For goodness sake,